Welcome to AIM On Air, the official podcast of the Association for Intelligent Information Management. Founded in 1944, AIM is dedicated to advancing the information management industry. We represent a vibrant global community of information leaders committed to driving exceptional business outcomes through information management fueled by technology like AI and automation. You can learn more at AIIM.org. I'm AIM President and CEO, Tori Miller-Liu, and I'm really looking forward to speaking with our guest today. He has transformed policy drafting by challenging the traditional negativity that surrounds rules and rulemaking. He's the developer of the Perfect Policies approach to useful, respectful language in policy drafting, which has been adopted in organizations around the world. His international bestseller, Rules, How to Write Rules That People Want to Follow, is now in its third edition and is also available in French. He has 40 years of experience as a practicing lawyer, a business consultant, and a federal civil servant, and he's served organizations like the Bank of Canada and the Canada Secretariat. He is also an industry thought leader for AIM and an AIM certified information professional. Please welcome to AIM On Air, Louis Eisen. Welcome, Louis.
Oh, hi, Tori. Thank you for having me.
You have such a cool bio, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
It's great. And it's just, it just screams like positivity. It's so nice. And I do feel like from personally knowing you, you're one of the most positive people I've met. Oh,
well, thank you. Because I'm always afraid it screams he can't hold a job.
You know? I mean, too, but that can be positive. No, I think, that was actually one of my first questions for you. You've had a really diverse career in law and consulting and information management, computer education. Can you tell me a little bit about that journey and how it all came together and informs what you do now?
Certainly, because I've actually come full circle. I'm going to start just before law. I did my degree in linguistics, my honors bachelor in linguistics at the University of Toronto, where I got really into languages and language expression. And then I went to law and I practiced for a few years. And you know, the thing about the law practice, Tori, is that there is no separation between information management and the work. The work is producing good information, good documentation. That's your job, to take the case and build a paper trail. That's consistent. So there was no separation. It was only until I started getting to other organizations that I saw business over here and the information management people over there. I transitioned out of law when the computers started coming out, desktop computers in the 80s, by teaching lawyers how to use the technology. And what they would do is say, this is nice, but what can I do with it? And then you'd have to sort of explain about how you put your information in there and organize it. And that was the kind of consulting I did for the next 20 years, training to learn, well, okay, here's what a spreadsheet is, but here's what goes in it, and here's what you need to come out of it. And we looked at databases and a variety of stuff. And I guess about after 20 years or so, in the early 2000s, the federal government in Canada started training judges to use computers. So I was taken on, and I would travel from province to province, teaching the Supreme Court judges how to use the technology in the same way. And after a short period, I became a civil servant. And then I moved into web content management, running the major government website at the time. And we didn't think of web content management as information management at the time, right? It was just web work. And at that time, I started writing policies because we were trying to come up with a consolidated look, consolidated approach to putting the information out there. Started learning about governance and whatnot. And that's where I learned that we were wrong in law school. That is, policies in law school are little contracts, little teeny contracts that you make, and they just extend the contract. But no, policies are much more than that. Policies help the business work better. And contracts are supposed to be adversarial, and policies are not. So it was when I got into that section, I realized that we've got to rethink how we do these policies. And I saw people arguing and agonizing a lot. We should include this. We shouldn't include that. Well, we should do this. And they've been writing legislation for years. And we said, well, isn't there something we can learn from the way legal, I mean, a policy is to a corporation what a statute is to a legislature. It's a list of decisions. And what can we learn by the way they structure theirs and apply it to ours? So that's what I started doing. So now, then I added the respectful language, which now brings me full circle back to the linguistic side, because I'm looking at how to reword things so that they sound strict and respectful.
That really did come full circle. I'm kind of curious about that moment where you had that epiphany around this policy doesn't need to be this negative, because my guess is at the time, and even still now, I feel like I'm surrounded by policies that do feel contractual, that feel burdensome, that feel negative. So how did you, when you're surrounded by that kind of mindset when it comes to policies, how did you come to that epiphany where you're like, you know what, this could actually be different?
Well, it was comparing the tone of policies to the tone of legislation. The policies had all these heavy words in it, like always and never and no exceptions, and lots of bold and underline and italic. Yeah. And it just seemed that what was happening was an enforcement issue. And policy writers, if they don't have any power, they do the only thing they can do, which is scream louder. And they do that by adding in bold and italic and underline and all that stuff. And I realized, so this is not working because we're talking at these people. Everybody is complaining that they're not engaged. But when I look at this stuff, it is so much harsher than the way legislation is worded. It's no surprise. That was the turning point.
So that's what I'm not understanding, though, because I think about legislation and it feels like it's worded harshly. It feels like it's law. It feels like it's the statutes of the land. Is it not?
Well, certainly a lot of legislation does have that heavy attitude to it. From my perspective, the most serious laws we have in any jurisdiction are the criminal laws. You know, the laws against murder and assault and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, how do those laws sound? Because they don't say nobody's allowed to assault anyone else and there are no exceptions. This is not the way they word. They all actually, I've done a survey of all 50 penal codes of the 50 states, and 80% of them use what we use in Canada, which is just a present tense format. A person who commits assault is liable to a fine or imprisonment. That's it. That's the policy. Doesn't say don't commit assault. It's just telling you what is. Here's how we deal with people who commit murder. Here's how we deal with people who commit kidnapping. And there's nothing aggressive about it. There's nothing suggesting that you're out to get around it. Very straightforward. So 80% of the US codes have that. Canada does. Britain, Australia, New Zealand, they all have that. France, Germany. So, people feel that, no, I have to be really mean. I mean, I grew up that way too. We have to really come down hard in order to get people to follow rules. But in fact, we have lots of rules that are just very straightforward.
Is there research that shows when you take that present tense, less aggressive approach, do you get better compliance?
I have no research. I have only anecdote. Okay. And the anecdote is people are, when we take away the rough language, people don't feel that we're working against them.
Hmm.
People feel this is a more collaborative thing. So we get along better. And from between the policy and the specialist and the specialist and the people, because we're not saying, don't do this and don't do that. Okay. We're saying a well-classified file has this attribute. Okay.
And so if I, as an executive, am looking at your book and thinking, okay, should I audit some of our policies? To me, what you're proposing and the reason to doing it is actually more about culture than compliance.
Absolutely.
Hoping that it helps with compliance, but to me, it feels like an improvement to the culture.
It's absolutely improvement of the culture. It's moving it from confrontational to collaborative. The culture that doesn't, a culture that doesn't divide rule makers from rule followers, which a lot of them do.
Hmm.
They're always addressing people in the you instead of in the we. And a culture where there isn't an expectation that you're trying to get around it, that we assume positive intent.
Yeah.
And you can tell that when you read the policies and they sound rough, usually there's something else going on behind there. There's some conflict. There are people who don't trust other people. And today, where people are really worried about their values and standing up for their values, if you're saying we're about respect for others and we're about collaboration, you're not walking the talk. If we can look at your policies and see that you're really about obedience.
Yeah. And I would, it'd be interesting if anyone has done research in this, maybe they can send it to Lewis and I, but
yeah,
I'd be really interested in research that could show any kind of correlation between this more positive approach to policy drafting and innovation and productivity. Because I would venture to guess that if you've empowered your people to follow rules as opposed to yelling at them to follow rules, they're probably more autonomous. They can probably be more creative, independent thinkers. Maybe they're better at taking risks, calculated risks, because you've created, I guess, psychological safety in a lot of ways, right?
The word empower is exactly what you're doing. So if you think policies are in order to keep people in line, if you have that approach, we got to keep everybody in line here, you're not empowering them, and you're creating a very toxic workplace. And the best engagement you can have in that toxic workplace is fine, we'll go along with it.
Yeah.
But if you get a workplace where you say, no, we want to empower our people. We want them to be trained. We want them to make decisions. We want them to be accountable for what they're doing and not just apply things by rote. Then you can get people into the cooperation and committed stage, the engagement stage.
Yes. And now hearing you frame it that way, it's interesting because I think a lot of the work that you produce has tentacles into other aspects of information management. And what you've just described is, in my mind, change management. It's going to beyond that buy-in to how do we actually affect change within this organization? I don't want you to just say yes to the rule. I want you to adopt it and feel like you have some ownership over it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Change management is a big piece of it. General communication is also a piece of it,
mm-hmm.
because we also, you know, communicate through emails. And one of the interesting things, I guess, about the policy stuff is that when you ask the people in the specialist area a question, they don't talk to you in that tone of voice. They just write in that tone of voice.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a sense that, well, the writing is supposed to be like that, and it just hasn't caught up. And, you know, the writing being like that, the right, those old policy the yelling that you were referring to, that is an historical vestige of two things. One is us growing up with parents and teachers who talk to us like that, where we learned that policy should sound bossy. If I'm giving you a rule, it should sound like I'm telling you what to do. But worse than that, we got into the work world, and for decades, centuries, bosses were allowed to yell at their people with impunity. There were bosses that would yell and scream and mistreat people, and there was nothing you could do about it. You remember that?
Yeah. That's,
and there was a culture shift maybe a couple decades ago, which said, no, we don't accept that anymore. You need to talk to your people like adults. You need to treat them with respect. And somehow that just hasn't filtered down to the written policies.
That's so interesting. So what are some of your theories about why it hasn't filtered down? What are the obstacles?
The obstacle to change is probably the greatest one, because when I run a workshop and I say to people, I teach them the stuff and they go, I love this, but my boss won't let me do it. So they throw their boss under the bus. But when you ask the boss, no, the boss is certainly fine with it. So what's creating that? To me, that's just fear of change. Is what that is. we're going to, I guess, talk a little bit about where the profession should be going. And I think it's all connected in terms of the kinds of stuff that the profession, the kinds of skills that they should be bringing on. It's important. We always talk about having them understand the business from the other side. But that isn't just the business activity. That's the business culture and attitude. What's this business? Is this business culture, we have deadlines and that just takes precedence over being careful? Like, is that that culture of that group that you're dealing with, which would could totally different from the group over here, which says, we don't drop a single penny. Accuracy is important, however long it takes. So those kinds of things we don't normally investigate. And yet, I think very much we need to work with change management with those approaches, those values, the culture piece, not just the mechanical transactional stuff that we're used to doing.
What I like about what you just said, too, is it's reminding me of, I found a few months ago, this business canvas model that actually encouraged you when you're coming up with your values or your priorities to set it as a less or more statement. So it's saying, it's not either or, it's not saying, you know what, our deadlines are more important than compliance. It's saying, we can choose both, but if you have to pick, this deadline's really important to us.
Okay.
So it is, I mean, I guess it is saying it's a little more important, but it's not, we don't throw compliance out the window. We're just saying like in this moment, like our value is on meeting our customer deadlines and meeting the milestones of the project. And we will work on compliance and that is a priority, but not everything can be equally important.
The other thing piece that we need to learn to do is take those values like compliance, which we think of as a value and nobody else does, and translate that into the value that actually resonates with most of the people in the organization. And I have to tell you, I think that's integrity. Integrity said, I did my work and I did it by the book. I didn't cheat. We did a good job. We followed all the rules. That's the value. Integrity. Compliance is simply one of the ways we get there. But we're not selling compliance. I mean, if we sell compliance, we got people going, yeah, yeah, yeah. But everybody wants to have a sense of integrity. And I think we have a lot of that value mismatch. We talk about preservation as a value. Very few businesses have preservation as a value. Maybe if you're Miami CSI or you're an archaeologist, preservation is a value. But we're not doing preservation for preservation's sake. We're doing preservation for accountability's sake. So what we're really doing is selling the value of accountability. That's what we're helping you with. We want you to be able to be fully accountable. And for that purpose, we need to collect your information. See the connection.
Yeah. And one thing you're making me wonder, though, is so say I've taken upon myself to transform my organization's policies to take this more positive present tense approach. What do I do about the policies that you look at it and there's just no clear purpose? You look at it and you're like, why is that a rule? Why is that a policy? Do you leave those on the book? Are they important? Do you get rid of them?
I think for every single policy we have, we should be able to trace it up to some strategy of the organization or some value or some principle behind it. Yeah, why are we asking people to swipe cards at the turnstile at the front? Why are we asking them to sign in the thumb drives in and out? Is it because we don't trust them? Or do we actually have a value here that we're trying to protect?
Yeah.
And maybe it's about stewardship. And what I found, because I also work with, HR and finance and all these different groups, everybody assumes that the other people in the organization understand the values from your perspective. So if you have control over the thumb drives for a security reason, and then you have a rule that says, no, you have to ask us before you take a thumb drive, they don't know it's a security reason. They think it's a control thing. They think you're a control freak. So unless you, and when you say to the people, say to the IT, the IM people, why are you doing this for security? And everybody will know that. No, guess what? They don't. Not everybody understands that this is the value that you are trying to preserve. And that's, I think we're opaque on that sense, you know, that a lot of times we have even things like retention or disposition, there are values we're trying to preserve, but we're really opaque about them.
And I can see from a leadership standpoint, that's one of your priorities then. When you're transforming your policies, when you're thinking differently about your policies, you have to prioritize communicating the why, and preferably, I would say, through a story, right? To make it
well,
to make
for
it
me, the why is about what's the value you're protecting? Because when somebody resists, it's because they have a competing value that they think is more important. Usually that value is something like personal freedom or personal preference. You know, I should be able to do it the way I want. That's a personal preference thing. And what we are saying as an organization, no, you know what? Accountability is more important than personal preference. Accuracy, we want you to use our date format because accuracy is more important than personal preference. That's the why.
Yeah.
That's what we want you to buy into. And it's not that your personal preference isn't important, right? As you said earlier, we're not getting rid of personal preference, but where there's a competing interest there. Because we value accuracy, we've decided that it supersedes your personal choice in this case. And that's where the why is. I hear stuff about stories a lot, and stories help us visualize what's happening. I don't have a problem with stories. I mean, we have to put things into context, but we need to know what the why is before we put that story together.
That's true. Yeah.
Okay.
You can use it as an illustration, but if you still can't clearly tell me why you're telling me I can't wear jeans.
Basically, yeah. Absolutely.
I like that.
And you know, the jeans, the dress code thing is very interesting because most people think of dress code as a control freak thing from their boss. Yeah. But if you were asked the boss, they'll tell you, no, this is an image and marketing thing.
Yeah.
Most people don't realize that. So that's why we need to raise the discussion up, I think, to the value end, and worry less about giving people instructions, do this, do this, do this. You know, I find most, because we're specialists in our field, we want to take the organization from here to there. And we know that the best way to go from here to there is to go straight, turn right, turn left, and turn left. So we write a policy that says you must go straight, turn right, turn left, and turn left. And we wonder why people aren't buying in.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, what is down there? And tell me the story of what's happening once we're down there, because I need to buy into that before I buy into any of your instructions. I need to buy into that vision, into that story, into that value. Otherwise, all your standards and procedures are going to go in one ear and out the other.
I like that you're, even in this conversation, you're sort of giving me a roadmap for, if I'm going to change this policy, here's the way to go about it. I define my why. I paint a picture of how we make that change, what the change is going to look like. I might add in a story to illustrate the importance of the change, but you always start with the fundamental why before even really picking up the pen and changing the policy and the verbiage itself, right? That's great. Okay, let me shift gears for a second because I'm going to couple this question. One, you speak at a lot of industry events. I know you're very familiar with the information management industry because you are a practitioner yourself and have had literally the title information management in past roles. I really want to know where you think the industry is headed over the next 2 years and how can practitioners take a leadership role in that future and handle some of the issues that they're going to be facing going forward.
Those are really good questions. And I want to answer without sounding doom and gloom. Okay.
Because that would be a change. You're very positive normally.
Yes, I know. But I'm worried a little bit about the future of the profession for a couple of reasons. I think we're fracturing. I think that we're losing people to things that seem to get a lot of attention and money, like AI, like freedom of information or data management, data guard. We're losing because these things are becoming more more prominent, and we're not getting a lot of people in the other way. And I think there's a reason for this fracturing, I have to tell you. And we are guilty of it. We as information management people guilty of it as well. And that is, I don't think we study the other professions enough to understand what they do and where we have synergies. I'm going to give you a real good example. You remember libraries, places with books and librarians. Okay.
I'm sure I've heard of those.
Yeah. A lot of librarians disappeared, and the librarians disappeared when the libraries did. And all of a sudden we have people saving research onto their disk. But instead of us in records and info management saying, whoa, this is research and needs to be organized, librarian, we have some work for you to do here. We said, oh, those are records now. So we need to lifecycle them like records, which are a totally different way you lifecycle than lifecycling research and reference information. But we didn't work with that group to say, okay, where can you help us? Now, I fault the librarians too. I mean, it's not just our fault. Librarians would say, if we didn't buy the collection, we're not curating it. Well, okay, if that's your attitude, you know, good luck with that. But I think there was a perfect opportunity for us to collaborate with another piece of our profession that we didn't. Where are there places from the archivists who are being marginalized that we can collaborate and work off each other and help each other? We take every new thing on, and it's because it looks like it's in our basket without actually having a bigger picture of, wait a sec, maybe some of this really could be handled better by this other group, and we need to work with them on that.
I think I agree with you in part, because I do believe that the future of our industry and the information management practice is very much dependent on collaboration and partnerships, like you're talking about, and really almost wearing the business analyst hat and understanding, okay, if you're working with law firms, what are their needs? If you're working with HR professionals or finance professionals, what are their specific needs? And then I think you could take that same approach with, we'll call them the complementary or tangentially related fields of archive, libraries, records. They're all very interrelated. I guess my question for you is, and one of the questions I've personally been grappling with is, when you're looking at some of the titles or professions that are related to data of any shape, whether it's in paper or digital, are the roles starting to merge? Like, you look at a data manager and an information manager, are those roles starting to merge? Are they going to be separate 10 years from now?
Yeah, no question they're starting to merge. But you say they're starting to merge, and instead of working together and respecting each other's skills, what we say is, oh, we need to learn about data management now. We need to learn about that skill now.
Yeah. Right?
We add it to ourselves. I had some brilliant insight for you that I just completely forgot.
No worries.
Oh, yes. AIM recently brought on another group, did you not?
We did, yes.
Hey, that's the first time in my memory in information management that somebody's reached out and said, here's another group that we can really work with. We've got a lot of overlap.
Yeah.
That's how rare it is. And I'll bet it didn't come easy. I'll bet there was a lot of work and a lot of talk that went into it to building those kinds of bridges. But that's what we need to do. So one of your questions was, where should the profession be going? I think one of the things we need to do is learn to build alliances better. Alliances with the other groups in information governance. When people are complaining, no one's following my rules and there's no enforcement. And I ask, well, do you work with HR on this? No, nobody's working with HR. They're the people who do enforcement. Do you work with audit on this? Half of them work with audit and half of them don't. But we need to build these alliances if we are actually going to have any clout.
And it sounds like you're not just talking about professional associations like AIM. Your example, to me, sounds like is saying to an information manager, when you were developing this policy or when you were trying to implement this project, did you involve IT? Did you involve
finance? That's what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah.
We tend to reach for IT because they're the known enemy. And I hate to call them like that, but that's, you know, the way some of them see them. They're the enemy. Sometimes we reach for freedom of information and data, but usually we reach for them for a bit of expertise instead of saying, how do we work together and pull on this?
Yeah.
I think if we are having a compliance problem, we need to work with HR. If we are having a reporting problem, that is, management up top is not seeing the risk, well, that's the job of audit. We need to work with audit. So I think when I was thinking about this question, I knew you were posing, what can we do to take on more of a leadership role? I think we need to move up from change management, which is where we've done a lot of pushing, one level higher into influencer. I think leaders need to learn to be influencers. And there's a number of ways they do that. One way is by building alliances. The second is by articulating a vision. And I think you mentioned a little bit of that earlier, being able actually to articulate what it looks like when we're there. And I know a lot of people get confused between a strategy and a vision or a mission and a vision. Mission, strategy, those are all, we're going to do this. We'll do this. We'll put, right? That's not what a vision is, right? A vision is what it looks like once it's done. Okay. We are very bad at articulating that. And I spend a lot of time when I'm helping people convert policies to standards. Show me what is the standard for well-managed information. Don't just tell me what to do. Let me see what does well-managed information look like. All right, it's classified, the private information is protected, there's nothing there that's past its retention period, et cetera, et cetera. A positively worded description of what success looks like. We don't have a lot of those, but if we're going to be influencers, we're going to need some of those.
I like that. So build alliances, articulate a vision. What else can I do to become an influencer?
I think you should articulate principles. We were talking about values and we jumped over to the comparison of values. I think we need to firm up that comparison or that buy-in to the values so that we can work off it. So for instance, when people are going to put in a policy, say an IG policy, they're trying to sell it up. And I say, before you go and give them the policy, you go 4 months earlier and you say, we're going to be proposing you a policy and here's what we're going to try and achieve. Standardization, uniformity, accountability, and preservation. Does that sound good by you guys? And you people, I'm sorry, by you in the decision board. And that's what you want right then for them to say, yes, that's what we want to achieve or to set you on a better path. Once you've done that, you take that away and you build all the policy standards, et cetera, that you're putting together to support those values and principles that you said you were going to sell them. So when you go back, half the work is done. As you said, that we have this corporate value and we wanted to, accuracy is really important. Our professional reputation is important. And one of the key elements of that is having accurate information, getting the trust of the public. So we are helping you get the trust of the public. We have put together the list in this policy of the different types of things that we need for that. But we're basing it on the direction that you gave us 4 months ago.
I see. So I'm thinking, I'll role play for a minute. Say I'm an information manager in a large enterprise. I want to roll out a new governance policy.
Right.
The direction and the advice I'm hearing here is start by finding who I can ally with to collaborate and build out this policy. Mm-hmm. I need to figure out how I articulate and tell the story of the vision, where we want to go. When this policy is done, this is what it would look like.
What does an organization with good governance look like?
Yes, yeah. And then for the values and principles, what does that look like in this scenario? Okay. How do I articulate those and what are they?
So one could be defensibility. One could be accountability. One could be flexibility. Maybe not. Values are very much to an organization, right? One of the, I did some work with the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva, and one of their values is neutrality. Well, of course, that makes perfect sense for them, doesn't it? So every business has values that make 100% sense for them, and we need to tie into those values.
I love that. And I like that for them, that was connected directly to their strategy. Yeah, it's that vertical connective tissue that you were talking about.
Yeah. And then when we want a governance policy in place or governance framework, and you get the buy-in right up early, what we're interested in is accountability, defensibility, maybe flexibility, maybe not, maybe you don't need that. Maybe some efficiency, maybe some reduction in turf war. And I'm sure there's a better word for it. But let's define right up front, like, what are the things what are some really good value words that describe what this is going to look like when it's done? Because they'll correct you if you're wrong, if they don't like what you're doing, but you won't have gone through all that work and then come and had that corrected, like right up front. You ever hear of priming? There's a story, a guy was standing at a supermarket with a tray of cheese, and people walked around and he said, "Would you like to try this cheese?" And everyone said, "No." The next day, he's doing the same thing, wear same clothes, but walked around. And this time he said, "Do you consider yourself adventurous?" And they said, "Oh, yeah. Would you like to try this cheese?" Well, now he got a whole bunch of people in. That's what priming is. That's saying to the people above, are you concerned about defensibility? Oh, absolutely. Are you concerned about the reputation we have with the public? Oh, absolutely. I'm concerned with that. All right. Let me show you how what we're doing here relates to the reputation we have with the public. And in order to keep that, we're going to propose in general terms that we do this, that we have this strategy, that we take control over this information, that our social media is more highly monitored. Like, get that stuff sold early so that when you come back several months later with statements that support it, you've done the selling. We know whether they're adventurous or not. You've done the priming.
And in that whole model, I'm assuming there's room too where the colleagues that you're collaborating with, they could potentially propose their own values or tweak the values that you've presented. And you would need to be open to changing your original vision and values, because I'm guessing if you collaborate, you're probably going to end up with a better product, right?
Absolutely. But I don't think you necessarily have to change so much as when you say collaborate, often we can piggyback. So for instance, if we're trying to increase compliance, there may be an organizational movement to improve the workplace environment and remove toxicity run by the HR group. Well, we can do that in our section by making some changes in our documentation. Maybe there's an initiative going on for client service. Well, you know what? This initiative is great. We've taken your client service values. Let's see how they apply here in information management, because we'd like to do exactly that inside with the rest of the service, the people here. And when you do that, you become a success story for them. They are now your champion because you are helping their big project. That's what it looks like.
I see what you mean, though, by using the word leader, because what you just described to me is, I almost feel like the title of information management is inadequate. What you're describing is an information strategist or an information leader, someone who can look across the enterprise and see, this is a great effort that HR is doing. Here's an opportunity for how I can help that. And at the same time, advance the goals of our information management program. And it's very strategic.
Well, you asked, what should IM professionals do to take on more of a leadership role?
Yeah.
So those things that you identify that are important for leaders, like, we need to learn the language of risk management, right? That's something leaders do. We need to be able to articulate a vision. We need to be able to take accountability for the strategies that we make. So I'm not a leadership expert, but I do say that I think in order to be an influencer, in order to have more credibility and sit at higher and higher tables, those leadership skills, we need to have them, because that's what the discussion is around those tables.
Oh, such good advice. And especially as we're in the age of AI and we're changing so rapidly, those are core human skill sets that people can focus on. I think that's a really great way to end this episode. Lewis, thank you so much for being on AIM on Air, and thank you for your insights.
My pleasure, Tori. Thanks for having me.